From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, two scholars re-examine the question, how did the Holocaust happen? First, we'll talk with Daniel Goldhagen, author of the controversial bestseller Hitler's Willing Executioners, about the Germans who did the work of genocide. He says they often killed with enthusiasm. Also, we talk with Saul Friedlander about the early years of the Nazi regime, why so many Germans went along with purging Jews from German culture, and why so many Jews didn't see what was coming. Friedlander's parents died in the Holocaust. Before they were captured, they sent him to live under a false identity in a Catholic seminary. Re-examining the Holocaust, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan gave a generally upbeat assessment of the nation's economy today in testimony before the Senate Banking Committee, but his report was laced with new caution about the soaring stock market.
Markets may have become more efficient, competition is more global, and information technology has doubtless enhanced the stability of business operations. But regrettably, history is strewn with visions of such new eras that in the end have proven to be a mirage.
Greenspan's remarks triggered a sharp drop in stock and bond prices, but both markets have subsequently recovered much of the lost ground. New Jersey Democrat Robert Torricelli is the only senator who says he's still undecided on whether or not to vote for a constitutional amendment to require a balanced federal budget. Supporters need Torricelli's vote to pass the measure. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Republicans are just one vote shy of the two-thirds needed to pass their version of a balanced budget amendment. They're reminding the public that Torricelli has voted for the measure in the past, but the freshman Democrat says he voted for a constitutional amendment in the House when the federal government was spending recklessly. Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott says even if Torricelli announces he'll vote no, Republicans won't give up.
The vote is never over until it's actually taken, and I think there may be some other senators that are still wrestling with this, even though they may not have said so publicly.
Torricelli has scheduled a news conference this afternoon to announce his intentions. He said he's most concerned the amendment is not flexible enough to allow the government to prepare for military action and to respond to economic downturns. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Zaire's rebel leader Laurent Kabila has entered preliminary talks aimed at ending Zaire's civil war. He secretly flew to South Africa yesterday on a chartered flight. Today, he met with U.S. and South African officials who are trying to broker a ceasefire. NPR's Michael Scholar has more.
Kabila is in a strong position. The rebel advance in eastern Zaire is now approaching Kindu, a provincial capital, mining town, and key military base. And once again, Zaire's defenses seem to be falling apart. If Kindu falls, Zaire's army will have just one airport and military base left in northeastern Zaire. That is in Kisangani, another rebel target. Morale is low in Zaire's army. Nine officers recently left the country and announced they will join the rebels. Rebel leader Kabila is meeting with senior American and South African officials, as well as with UN Special Envoy Mohamed Sanoun. Representatives of Zaire's President Mobutu are also in South Africa, but apparently the two sides have not yet agreed to meet face-to-face. This is Michael Scholar in Nairobi.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 55 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, Fed Chairman Greenspan's remarks today were reminiscent of his warning to the markets in December, but his words this time were more pointed. One analyst says Greenspan is trying to talk the market down. More on the market's reaction now from Bloomberg's Doug Krisner.
The market tumbled after the Fed chairman said that an increase in interest rates may be necessary to keep inflation contained. At its worst point of the morning, the Dow was down by more than 100 points. Within the 30-stock average, shares in Philip Morris are higher after the company announced a 3-for-1 stock split. But McDonald's weakened after the Wall Street Journal reported the company is cutting prices to revive sagging sales. I'm Doug Krisner.
Lufthansa faces a possible strike after the airline's pilots gave formal approval for a walkout if the German carrier does not sweeten its latest contract offer. Lufthansa says it will not change the offer, which is based on a deal made last year with the airline's groundworkers union. The nation's two submarine builders have agreed to work together to build the Navy's next generation of nuclear submarines. The Newport News Shipbuilding Company of Virginia and General Dynamics Electric Boat Corporation of Connecticut will each build parts for four submarines rather than building two complete vessels each. Each sub is expected to cost the government $1.5 billion. Japanese car exports to the U.S. rose 75% in January compared to the same month last year. Those figures were announced today, just 3 days after Secretary of State Madeleine Albright warned during a visit to Tokyo that there could be new trade friction if Japan does not make good on its pledge to open up its market to American-made cars. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations. Contributors include the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve health and health care for all Americans.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we consider one of the most disturbing questions of the 20th century. How did the Holocaust happen? We'll hear from the authors of two books that tackle that question. First, Daniel Goldhagen, whose bestseller Hitler's Willing Executioners has just been published in paperback. Although his conclusions have been controversial, the book is a bestseller here and reached number one on the bestseller list in Germany. It's nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award, and next month Goldhagen flies to Germany to receive the Democracy Prize, awarded by the Journal for German and International Politics. Goldhagen's book is about the perpetrators of the Holocaust, not the architects, but the Germans who actually did the work of genocide. He doesn't go along with the theory that these people were just taking orders, or that they were forced to follow orders.
Most of the notions that have been put forward, and most of what people themselves who have thought about this have generally believed, has not been based on any detailed knowledge of the killers and of the circumstances of their killing. And when I, in writing this book, I've done a great deal of research into the lives of these people based on the testimonies they themselves have given, mainly to the legal authorities of the Federal Republic of Germany. And they themselves, in their testimonies, provide a different portrait of their lives as killers, of their motivations, of the details of their deeds. And so my book is really based mainly on their own words. It is told in their own words. And they tell us, contrary to what many have believed, that they were not, by and large, under coercion. In the history of the Holocaust, never was a single German perpetrator himself ever killed, sent to a concentration camp, jailed, or punished in any serious way for refusing to kill Jews. It simply never happened.
Was it understood between the lines, though, that if they did refuse, something terrible would happen to them?
In fact, in many units, it was precisely the opposite, because the commanders told their men, they announced to their men, that they didn't have to kill if they didn't want to. They'd be given other duties. Only a few of the men availed themselves of the opportunity to exempt themselves from the killing. The others saw that they weren't punished, that this was not a ruse, it was a genuine offer, and so that they too had the opportunity to exempt themselves. And yet the vast majority of the men essentially chose to kill Jews. And we know these offers were genuine because, as I said, they have told us this during their post-war testimony, that the offers were made to them. And so this presumption of coercion is merely that, a presumption, and it is really, it does not accord with the historical record.
What did reading the testimony teach you about the motivation of the killers?
The general portrait that people have had of these killers, aside from the fanatical SS men who, the proverbial fanatical SS men, is that the ordinary Germans who must have been involved were reluctant killers dragged to a task against their will, given no choice. The portrait that they themselves paint of the killing, of the actions of their comrades, is not of such reluctant people, but of people who are energized, who are pursuing the deaths of their victims with zeal, who are doing not less than they have to do or as little as they have to do, but who are often or typically doing more than they have to do.
What do you think explains the virulence of the anti-Semitism in Germany during World War II?
Well, to understand the development of anti-Semitism or anti-Semitism during this period, you have to look at its development and go back historically. And In Germany, already in the 19th century, there was an axiomatic view of Jews in German society, which held Jews to be different from Germans. The differences were conceived of as residing in their biology. This was conceptualized in terms of race. Jews were considered to be powerful and evil and to have done great harm to Germany and to be a continuing threat to the well-being of Germany. Now, this view, which was really shared by the vast majority of Germans in the 19th century, was reproduced from generation to generation because this is all what young people growing up in Germany were exposed to. And so when Hitler came to power, he actually came to power in a society which essentially shared his views of Jews, and that's why it was so easy for him to mobilize so many Germans already in the 1930s in a radical persecution of the 30s, and then even in the extermination of the 40s when he took the order to kill European Jewry.
But, you know, anti-Semitism was hardly unique to Germany. What was it, do you think, that was unique about German anti-Semitism? Anything?
I think it had certain singular features. But the issue, in part, is not whether it was unique. There were other parts of Europe, or in other parts of Europe, there were people who shared this basic model of Jews that I've described. For the Holocaust to occur, you needed two factors. And this is true of genocides in general. We can think of this is true of the genocide that occurred recently in Rwanda, the killings in the former Yugoslavia, and many others. The two factors are that you need to have a state which will mobilize people in a program of extermination, but they have to be able to draw on a populace that is willing to do the bidding of the state to kill people. And this requires that the populace have a deep animus towards the victim group. There has to be a deep hatred on the one hand and a state to mobilize that hatred. Now, in Europe, even though there was anti-Semitism in many other countries, it was only in Germany that both these factors came together, a deeply and broadly anti-Semitic public and a Nazi state that decided to turn private hatreds into the core of state policy and enact a program of extermination. And so whether German anti-Semitism is singular or whether it was reproduced elsewhere is not even so much the issue. The issue is the nexus between deep societal hatreds, the beliefs that people have about the chosen victim group, and the mobilizing state.
Daniel Goldhagen is my guest, and his book, Hitler's Willing Executioners, has just been published in paperback. Some people interpret your book as a statement that there was something in the German national character that led to this virulent anti-Semitism that led to the Holocaust. Do you think that there was something in the German national character?
No, I reject the notion of national character as it's understood. The book is not about some unchangeable properties of Germans. It is really about the beliefs that people had about the world. It's about the political culture, the notions that existed in Germany, and the views that ordinary Germans as individuals had about Jews and how this influenced their actions towards Jews and their approval of what was taking place. So today, for example, most Germans don't share these views because Germany has changed enormously. It's become a democratic country, and anti-Semitism has declined and been transformed as well.
And you say you don't believe in collective guilt.
Collective guilt is a notion which is indefensible both conceptually and morally. Guilt can always be only individual. It's not a property of a collectivity. And the only people who are to be deemed guilty are those who actually committed crimes. The thrust of the notion of guilt is a legal one, and it is, and we attribute guilt to people who have committed some legal transgressions. We don't call people guilty in our society today, and we shouldn't in Germany of the time, for the beliefs which they had. We may deem these beliefs to be reprehensible, but we don't call people guilty for thinking certain things. And so the notion of collective guilt is, as I said, indefensible, and I'm firmly opposed to it, and there's nothing in the book which supports the notion. What the book is really about, and this actually gets back to much of what we've been discussing, is the notion of individual responsibility. In the book, I shift attention away from away from the ways in which people have talked about these people, mainly as being robots, essentially being moved by external forces against their will, to say that people actually made choices. The perpetrators made choices all the time. Ordinary Germans in the 1930s, when Jews were being discriminated against, made all kinds of choices. And what I've tried to do is to uncover the patterns of choices they made, to ask, well, why did they choose to strike a Jew, to strike Jews, rather than not to strike Jews? And to recognize that these were human beings, agents, you know, people who were sovereign over their own actions, and to uncover the reasons why they chose to act in one way or another. So the book is all about individual responsibility of people for their own actions, and recognizes fundamentally their humanity in this way. It's not about collectivity, and it's not and the purpose of the book is not to assign guilt in any way. It's really to investigate the historical circumstances and the deeds of these people, and to try to explain them.
I think a lot of our listeners probably just saw Schindler's List on television, and I'm wondering if you've seen the movie and if you have any thoughts about it.
I saw the movie when it first came out, and I think that the movie has done a tremendous job in reawakening interest in the Holocaust among many people, and in conveying really forcefully and sometimes graphically for the first time to many people certain central aspects of the Holocaust. And so there are some brilliant scenes in the movie. The clearing of the Krakow ghetto is one of them, where you see the ferocity of the Germans who are rounding up Jews and in order to deport them to their deaths. And when you watch that scene, the question to ask yourself, do these look like people who disapprove of what they're doing, which is what most of the theories that have been put forward of the Holocaust have maintained, that they were forced to do something one way or another, or brought to do something of which they disapproved. And the scene conveys the zeal, the energy, the ferocity of these perpetrators. And so I think the movie, for this and other reasons, has done a great deal to get people to think about certain issues regarding the Holocaust, certain issues of the Holocaust. And so I'm very happy that Spielberg made the movie that he did.
Daniel Goldhagen is the author of the bestseller Hitler's Willing Executioners, which has just been published in paperback. We'll talk with Holocaust scholar and survivor Saul Friedlander after a break. This is Fresh Air. How did Germans get to the point of accepting and going along with Hitler's goal of exterminating the Jews? Saul Friedlander examines that question in his new book, Nazi Germany and the Jews, Volume 1, The Years of Persecution, 1933-39. He's a scholar of the Holocaust and a survivor. Before his parents were captured and sent to their death in a camp, they brought him to a Catholic boarding school where he was able to change his identity and remain in hiding until the end of the war. In his new book, Friedlander examines the unique brand of anti-Semitism that developed in Germany under Hitler in the 30s, leading up to the final solution. Friedlander calls it redemptive anti-Semitism.
Yes, well, redemptive anti-Semitism really is the anti-Semitism driving the core of the party and Hitler himself. It means very simply, I think that the anti-Jewish hatred dominates the ideology. You see, for Hitler, I think this was the core of his thinking and ideology. Secondly, the basic idea is the world will be saved, or Aryan humanity will be saved, if the Jews disappear. It doesn't mean at the beginning are exterminated, but somehow are annihilated. So redemptive anti-Semitism means exactly what it says, that is, the redeeming of the world and of Aryan humanity by the disappearance or the annihilation of the Jews.
So you have this idealistic goal wedded to the anti-Semitism, so people could see exterminating the Jews as ultimately being uplifting. It's going to save the race.
Yes. Idealistic in quotes, right?
Right. I mean, no, exactly. Idealistic in quotes, right.
It's
exactly.
This kind of vision that the race, that Aryan humanity, and these are sentences used all the time, Aryan humanity will be saved by the annihilation of the Jews. But careful, I mean, in the 30s, during the 30s, annihilation doesn't mean necessarily in the minds even of that elite, that Nazi elite, and not even necessarily in Hitler's mind, it doesn't mean a concrete plan of extermination.
Right, that plan wasn't developed until later.
Until later, but with Hitler, you see, you sense from 35 on that this murder, I mean, he scans the horizon as if to find the worst possible solutions, in a way, for the Jews. And he hints, already in 35, at the possibility of at some moment, if there is war, as he says, on both fronts, like 1914, 1918, Germany fighting then on in the West and on the East, he says, well, then I will be ready for the worst, for the most extreme consequences regarding mm-hmm. the Jews, which is a hint already. And these hints come and get more and more explicit. And in 39, in his speech at the Reichstag, he clearly speaks of extermination. Also, this is not yet a concrete plan.
You know, you point out that Jews were never more than about 1% of the population in Germany.
Yeah, even slightly less.
So why were they so feared? Why were they perceived as such a big problem if there were so comparative few of them in the country?
Well, exactly. You know, that's the whole problem of anti-Semitism, that anti-Semitism isn't based on something real. It is based on a phantasm, on something totally imaginary. You have other cases like that in our societies, but not as strong as that. I think this is the most extreme example of a group being feared and hated on purely fictitious, on imaginary grounds. And this was particularly strong during the period I'm dealing with. You know, it has very deep roots. It has very, very deep roots in that case, which these roots or these impulses coming from way back, and let's be very open about it. Part of it comes from the Christian background, its representation of the Jew. Then it's secularized in a way and enters into secular culture and with additions like racial theories and so on. But it is a kind of phantasmatic, a kind of imaginary world, you know, the world of conspiracies. There are people around who see history as a huge conspiracy, and they always have some idea that this and this group is at the center of the conspiracy, is really manipulating humanity. And that is one of those extreme, extreme examples.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Saul Friedlander. He's a historian of the Holocaust and author of the new book, Nazi Germany and the Jews, The Years of Persecution, 1933 to 1939. When Hitler came to power in 1933, the first sector that was purged from public life in Germany was the arts and culture. Why pick on that? And how did he pick on that?
Well, you know, and this is true. It's usually forgotten that even before the laws of April of that year, 1933, which expelled civil servants of Jewish background and so on, the first to be hit were the artists. They were the first to flee. But this came in a way from the party. You know, there were no clear instructions. Suddenly, Jewish artists were not allowed to perform anymore. They were not allowed, let's say, to conduct concerts anymore or to play. The radio was closed to them. Within weeks, they had to flee the country. There are famous ones, Bruno Walter, Otto Klemperer and others. Max Liebermann, the famous painter, had to resign from the Prussian Academy of the Arts, and so on and so forth. Einstein never came back to Germany, understanding the situation. The theater, famous theater director Max Reinhardt, had to resign or was dismissed from the German theater and left the country, and so on and so forth. Hundreds and hundreds of less important, less well-known artists suddenly were without any possibility of performing or of actually existing in Germany anymore. Why? Well, the Jewish spirit was being extirpated from German society.
And that spirit was feared to be coming across in the arts, and so that had to be...
Well, yes, you know, I say the Jewish spirit, obviously, again, in quotes, that's right. How the Nazis were defining it. The Jewish spirit was corrupting German culture, German society, symbolically and really for them, for the Nazis. The immediate thing, in a way, the instinctive and most natural thing was to eliminate the most visible mm-hmm. aspect of the Jewish spirit.
Now, a lot of artists and intellectuals started to leave Germany
right.
early on because of that. On the other hand, a lot of Jewish artists and intellectuals stayed.
That is true.
And you have to ask yourself, how come they didn't see what was coming?
Well, nobody saw what was coming. You see, it's not only artists and intellectuals. The Jews, the simple, the ordinary German Jew didn't leave. Most of, you know, emigration, the first year you had 37 or something, 1,000 people leaving, and then it went down to the 20,000 and something, 24,000, 22,000 per year. This was very little and very slow. People could not see what was coming. You see, we tend to read history backwards. We know what came afterwards, and we imagine that people, by looking very carefully at the situation, could imagine the worst. Well, they could not.
Is part of the reason, do you think, why Jews in Germany didn't see what was coming? Because Hitler didn't necessarily see what was coming either. I mean, when Hitler came to power, he didn't necessarily plan on exterminating all the Jews in Germany.
Absolutely. That's the core point. You see, the Nazis themselves had, I think you could say that their first aim was to segregate the Jews in Germany from German society. First, through the professions and so on, and then biological segregation, you know, the Nuremberg laws and so on. Then expel them as much as possible from Germany. That is forced emigration, then really physical expulsion. There were no plans for extermination, and that was not mentioned nor planned in any way before 1939, before the war. So the Nazis didn't plan that ultimate phase at the time. Obviously, the Jews couldn't see something that wasn't planned and certainly couldn't imagine the worst. Nobody could, really. Also, the worst happened.
Saul Friedlander is the author of the new book, Nazi Germany and the Jews, The Years of Persecution, 1933 to 39. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our discussion with Saul Friedlander about Germany in the mid-30s and why German intellectuals, the church, and the public passively accepted the increasing persecution of the Jews. And he'll tell us how he survived the Holocaust. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Saul Friedlander, author of the new book Nazi Germany and the Jews, The Years of Persecution, 1933 to 39. It examines the unique brand of anti-Semitism in Germany and the political and social climate that fed that anti-Semitism. A little later, we'll hear how Friedlander survived the Holocaust. Let's get back to the early and mid-1930s, after Hitler rises to power. What did the German intellectuals have to say about the early purges of Jewish people from German culture?
Well, they didn't say much. Actually, they said nothing. But in the, let's take now the establishment, the universities and so on. Over almost 1,500 Jewish teachers, professors, various ranks were expelled from German universities in 1933 to 1935, actually. Then everybody was expelled. So let's say, all in all, at the end, you had several thousands of Jewish intellectuals expelled from the intellectual establishment, let's call it that way. Their colleagues said nothing. In one or two cases, there were attempts. There were certainly attempts to help individually, but the collective behavior is extraordinarily shameful. This intellectual elite completely lost its moral grounding, or whatever you want to call it, at that moment. I mean, no voice, no strong voice, individual or collective, expressed itself, I would say not one, to say the Jews have the right to continue to be part of our intellectual life. We protest against this action. I know it was dangerous. I understand that very well. And we need not demand extraordinary courage from people who behave, like most people, without unusual courage in life. But nobody really expressed. And you speak of the intellectuals, the universities, but the churches behave the same way, you see.
You say that the boycott of Jewish businesses was the first major test on a national scale of the attitude of the Christian churches toward the Jews. Why was the boycott the first indication of what the church attitudes would
well,
be?
Well, because the boycott was the first major open collective action taken by that new regime. Don't forget, Hitler comes to power on January 30, 1933. The boycott is decided for April 1st, 1933. So, 2 months later. This is the first major, massive, nationwide action against the Jews. The German citizenry is not allowed, under the boycott regulations, let's say, to buy in Jewish stores, in Jewish shops, in Jewish businesses. Nobody protests, you see. And the church, the churches as moral institutions, as expressing the morality, in a way, of the Christian population, they were asked by some individuals to react. There was a question posed by several clerics to the bishop, to various bishops, should we not say something? The general answer of the bishop of Berlin, the bishop of Munich, the bishop of Breslau, was the Jews can take care of themselves. If we do something, Hitler will turn against in that case Catholicism. The same situation happened with the Protestants. There was worse, by the way. Some very high Protestant dignitaries declared themselves openly at the time to be anti-Semites. Bishop Dubelius, for instance.
The Nazi policy was not only to exterminate the Jews; they also tried to exterminate homosexuals and gypsies, and succeeded in many cases in doing just that. How would you compare how the Nazis saw the threat of homosexuals and gypsies with the threat of the Jews?
Yes. They tried to annihilate and exterminate various groups. And indeed, you mentioned the homosexuals and the gypsies, the two, and don't forget the mentally retarded people, the mentally ill patients, who were, by the way, the first group to be exterminated, as you know. The moment the war started, the extermination of the mentally ill started in various asylums and special clinics in Nazi terms, and some 80,000 were killed within a year and a half. Now, the difference, these groups were exterminated, and the Jews were exterminated later on a huge scale, obviously. But not the scale is the problem. I think that in all those cases, the Jews, the Gypsies, the mentally ill, the homosexuals, these groups were considered as polluting the race, as selling the race. They had to be eliminated because they were in a way racial dangers to the Aryan, to the pure Aryan race. So there was a racial, in quotes, cleansing. It was a racial cleansing operation on the Nazi side. The Jews, beyond that, were considered as a world danger. That is, they were considered as a kind of active danger which endangered not only the race, but in a way Aryan humanity as such. They were an active force. They were a conspiracy, as we said before. They attempted to undermine the Aryan Germanic world. So on top of this racial kind of pollution of those groups, including the Jews, and leading to their extermination, the fight against Jewry was, in Nazi eyes, led at many other levels against this world danger, and actually that was ideologically the core of their fight, both against the capitalist world in the West and the Bolshevik world in the East.
So Jews were part of this larger, were perceived to be part of this larger conspiracy.
They were not only part of it, they were
leading it.
They were behind it.
Right. So the Jews were an active threat, whereas homosexuals and gypsies and the mentally ill would pollute Aryan purity,
exactly.
But they weren't conspiring against the world
exactly.
The way the Jews were.
You got it exactly. Exactly.
How much did the public go along with all these anti-Semitic policies, with the purging of Jews from the culture? And how, I mean, if you took the temperature of the German public then, what would it be?
Well, the public went along. The elites went along, as we said before, you know, the universities, the churches, and so on. And the public went along. But again, the public went along passively. The public accepted. The public turned the other way. The public didn't consider this certainly as its first concern or its major concern. The public understood that the party, the Nazi party, and the Nazi elite, and Hitler particularly, were behind it totally. They didn't want to confront that. They didn't like the violence. They didn't like the disorder. They didn't like the kind of random actions. And that's why when the Nuremberg laws came in 1935, most of the public accepted them very positively, because they thought, well, that is that. That's more or less the framework in which now things will be settled. That is, the Jews will be a minority under their own rules, in a way, ruled by the regime and the state. But there will be a separation, and they were quite pleased with that. The average German didn't mind at all the segregation of the Jews, which doesn't mean that there were not Germans who minded it. And I do stress in the book that there were other Germans. I want to stress it also in this program. But the majority was indifferent, went along. There are, let's say, various degrees of inertia, as we know in our society, various degrees of inertia, of turning the other way, of just not caring.
The Nuremberg laws that you referred to in 1935 basically defined what citizenship was and who could be a citizen, and Jews could not be citizens, so they were just stripped of rights in Germany. So you're saying that the German public was anti-Semitic enough on the whole to say, you know, fine, strip them of their rights, segregate them, but the German public wasn't kind of clamoring for more action, and they certainly weren't clamoring to exterminate the Jews. They just
were
passive in their acceptance of this increasing anti-Semitic policy.
That's exactly what I'm saying. I think, you know, there is a great difference between this kind of passive acceptance, which then does not set any, allows the system, the regime, the party, to pursue its policies without hindrance. You know, nobody opposes it. There is this passive acceptance, which you defined. But there is no clamoring on the part of the public, on the part of society at large, go and kill them, go and expel them all out of the country. There is not this kind of eliminationist anti-Semitism, the desire to have the Jews disappear. The public simply accepts, goes along, and doesn't mind, probably, and certainly doesn't oppose or doesn't express any opposition.
Daniel Goldhagen, in his bestseller, Hitler's Willing Executioners, says that the German public was so anti-Semitic that the average German was willing to participate in the genocide, that a lot of the people who were the workers in the genocide, they weren't specially trained, they weren't members of the elite SS, they weren't even members of the Nazi Party. Plus, there was no threat that they would be punished if they didn't want to participate in the genocide. They could have been reassigned. He said there's no evidence anyone was ever punished for refusing to carry out the genocide. So I wonder what your interpretation of that is, and if you were agree that anti-Semitism was so deep that ordinary Germans carried out the genocide with enthusiasm.
No, I would see differently. Ordinary Germans did carry these massacres and this torture willingly. They participated, as described, but not necessarily because they were carrying in their heads some kind of eliminationist anti-Semitic system. This explanation is again much too simple. They carried out what they were told to carry out, what they were encouraged to carry out. Their sadism came out. Their cruelty came out. They had this image. I mean, the Jews were targeted as the worst, and therefore they were told, "You are allowed. You can just go ahead." And many people under circumstances like that would act more and more cruelly against a group, more and more debased, tortured, humiliated, vilified, and ultimately killed in front of you. All that happened, but not necessarily because German society was actively clamoring for the extermination of the Jews. German society was suffused with anti-Semitism, with this kind of traditional anti-Semitism, but it was mainly passive about it. The active killers became activated in this context of the general killing and of the encouragement they were given, do kill this group.
But still, you'd agree that they were willing to do it when given the chance.
Oh, absolutely.
And were enthusiastic about it in many instances.
Yes, but not necessarily because of eliminationist anti-Semitism as a kind of general ideology of the German society at the time.
You mean for some people it was just a chance to really give in
to sadism?
Well,
a chance to release their group sadism or their individual sadism, absolutely.
My guest is Holocaust scholar and survivor Saul Friedlander. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Saul Friedlander, author of Nazi Germany and the Jews, Volume 1, The Years of Persecution, 1933 to 1939. I can only assume that part of the reason why you've written all your life about the Holocaust is because you survived it. You were born in Czechoslovakia. Your parents died in the camps. But before they died, they put you in a Catholic boarding school, and you were raised as a Catholic.
Right.
Were you old enough when you were put into the Catholic school to know that you were really Jewish?
Yes. We were a very assimilated family. We were not practicing Jews. We hardly kept any, my family hardly kept any, if I may say anything, Jewish. But when we fled to France and when we fled then to the center of France and when things got worse and worse before we were separated, the talk about Jewish things grew and we remember the Hanukkah feast of 41, the Hanukkah celebration of 41, where all this was discussed very, very emotionally. I still can remember that very vividly. And then in 42, my parents were tempted to cross to Switzerland, were caught and delivered to the Germans, shipped to the East. I was put in a monastery where I spent 4 years as a Catholic, hidden there. I knew I was 10 when I was put in that place, and I knew, obviously, I was Jewish. I understood that I was being hidden. But I didn't know then what was happening, really. I didn't know. When I came out, I hadn't heard about Auschwitz, about the killings. I all that was told to me. I couldn't know all that.
When you were in the monastery, you were thinking that you were called to be a priest.
Yes, I became a Catholic. I was a child who was converted under the circumstances. And I suddenly, this world became my world. I didn't know of anything else after that. And as in that place, the youngsters who were there were all destined to become priests, I just was one of them. And it's only at the end of the war, actually, months after the end of the war, that I was told about what had happened, and I started to understand where I was and what was happening to me. And it took time, but I went back to my own identity as a Jew, and then 2 years later I emigrated to Israel, but on kind of illegal ship. But it took time to get back.
Do you have any memories of your last time with your parents before they said goodbye to you and put you in the Catholic monastery?
Yes, sure. Very clear memories, unfortunately. All this took place in a very small, in a small industrial city in the center of France, in Montluçon. My parents had me taken to that monastery. They hid in a hospital in that city before leaving for the Swiss border with a group and hoping to cross the border, which, as I said, they didn't manage to do. They crossed, but they were then taken back. I ran away from the monastery after a few days, and I knew somehow where they were in that hospital. I had heard it or something, and they were under another name, but I figured it out. How I knew this, I cannot tell you today. But the fact is that I did find the hospital. I found the place where they were. I found their room, and I went there and simply didn't want to leave, you see, and that is it's very bad to this very day. In any case, they had to call the monastery. Two nuns came and took me, dragged me out actually of that room, and that's the last time I saw my parents.
Did you understand that your parents were trying to save your life, or did you think that they were rejecting you?
Well, that's a child. Don't forget, I was not yet 10 years of age, so what one understands at that time is not exactly what one understands later. I certainly understood they were meaning well. they were trying to do something for me, surely, but I guess that one gets very, very difficult reactions if one clings to the parents and one is torn away. So it's difficult to say how I really saw it at that time, because that somehow has disappeared with time, but where it is, I don't know.
My guest is Saul Friedlander, author of the new book, Nazi Germany and the Jews, The Years of Persecution. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Holocaust scholar Saul Friedlander. He survived the Holocaust by hiding out in a monastery where he passed for Catholic. He resumed his Jewish identity after the war. Was it hard to integrate those two parts of yourself, the part of you that was Jewish and the part of you that was Catholic? I mean, you'd even gotten a new name when you were Catholic.
Yes, well, I changed, but the changing of the name indeed was linked to the Catholicism, but was also linked to the fact that I had to be totally hidden.
Exactly,
and therefore,
right.
My name as Friedlander couldn't appear anywhere. I became Paul-Henri-Marie Ferland. It was in France. Paul-Henri-Marie Ferland, which is a totally Christian name, let's say. And it created this kind of new identity, as you say. Yes, well, that's for my generation of children, let's call it that way, or very young, adolescents, we're thousands now. We are not so young anymore, I would say. But for us, this problem of hiding, changing identity, and so on, has, I think, gone after us all our lives.
I wonder if you've been thinking a lot about the position Madeleine Albright is in, about having learned about her past.
Well, you know, as everybody, I was struck. I mean, this story, this revelation, in a way, was I certainly noticed it very. It made a great impression on me. Her choices are her choices, but she's 2-3 years younger than I am, but that's my generation of people who, in one way or the other, became Catholics, let's say, because of the war, because of the Nazis, because of the Holocaust. And some of us, many of us actually, became Jews again. Others chose differently. You know, I cannot judge a personal choice, but I personally feel ill at ease with the hiding of one's identity. There is another example, the Paris Cardinal Lustiger, the Archbishop of Paris. He's also part of that generation, and he became a very high-ranking prelate of the Catholic Church. But he all the time reaffirms, in a way, his Jewish origin, saying, "My name is Aaron Lustiger," that's his Jewish name, let's say. Now he's Pierre-Marie or Jean-Marie Lustiger, but he came to Israel and very clearly stated his identity. So it's another choice. He remained a Catholic. He became an archbishop and a cardinal. But he says, you know, I'm basically Jewish. I say I'm a Jew, and that is that, nothing else. Some other people will say, well, by now we are Catholics or Episcopalians or something, and that's what we are. These are very personal choices.
I have one more question for you. You've been writing about the Holocaust for years. What is the question that you find most perplexing, the question that, of all the other questions, you just can't comprehend?
Well, you know, I think it's a question that bothers everybody. I think that here the historian and everybody who thinks of those events has the same question. How could it happen? How could a human society produce a system that led to the systematic extermination of millions of human beings because they were born Jews, but they were born white or black or whatever. I mean, because they were this category of human beings, they had to be killed to the last one. I mean, this, whatever the explanations and whatever, you know, our interpretations and whatever I can say about ideology and anti-Semitism and so on, this is still the question which I cannot comprehend.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Saul Friedlander is the author of Nazi Germany and the Jews, The Years of Persecution, 1933 to 39. It's the first of a two-volume work. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Fred Snyder, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Regina O'Toole is our intern. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Knopf, publishers of Nobel laureate Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon in a hardcover edition. This is NPR, National Public Radio.